Hello and welcome to another episode of History Lesson Part 2. I'm Jackson McDonald.
I'm Tyler Shipley.
The film we will be discussing on today's episode is 1987's Matewan, I believe is how it is pronounced. I feel like it's pronounced a couple different ways over the course of the movie. Directed by John Sayles and starring Chris Cooper, James Earl Jones, Bob Gunton, and David Strathairn, among others. It tells the story of the Battle of Matewan in 1920, a violent altercation between unionized coal miners and the, what is the name of the mining company again? Now it's escaping me.
Stone Mountain.
And I suppose it actually may, you know, it is a war between the, a labor war between the, between labor and capital, out in the coal mines in West Virginia in 1920, but it's also maybe more accurately a war between the workers and the Baldwin Felts detective agency working on behalf of the Still Mountain Mining Company.
Yeah. The Pinkertons.
Yeah. So this was, because I'm going to have a lot of questions for you, because this is not something that I necessarily know very much about. Like, I obviously know that, you know, from the late 1800s into the first 20 or so years, well, 20, 30 years of the 20th century, labor and capital fought at a level of intensity and violence that is almost kind of unprecedented at any other point in history. And to a point that is almost like hard to believe today. But like this incident specifically was the first time I'd ever heard any of these people or any of this happening, other than just understanding vaguely, like, oh yeah, like a bunch of people tried to unionize, like, you know, there in about 100 or so years ago. And, you know, they used to send the Pinkertons in all the time to kill them or whatever. But like the Pinkertons were their own detective agency, weren't they? Were they not? Like,
yeah.
Or is that just like a word for, you know, detectives that are actually mercs?
Yeah, it's become that. The Pinkertons, okay, were a specific company, but yeah, I think it's now kind of like it just is a stand-in for, yeah, basically mercs on behalf of capital who specifically do strike breaking and,
right,
and union,
yes,
busting, and you know, and breaking and busting, you know, in like a literal sense. You know, because obviously we think of strike breaking and union busting today, and it's like, you know, I mean, it sometimes still has violence, but it's often a more kind of subtle and bureaucratic, undermining, legalistic process.
Yeah,
but,
more sophisticated,
you know, in those
almost.
Days. Yeah, exactly. More sophisticated, and also like, I mean, labor isn't arming itself with shotguns and rifles and
no,
you know, plotting ambush. Like, you know, the teachers' union isn't plotting to shoot Doug Ford, like, you know.
No,
it's just,
I mean, that would be so cool if they were though.
it is like such a different, just a completely different context.
There are a lot of things depicted in this movie that feel totally alien from just anything that would happen now, particularly the role in the battle. But that is sorry, I just woke up. I stayed up very late last night watching this movie, so I'm a little discombobulated
this, yeah,
right now. But like the one thing that stands out the most as something that would never happen now is like the role of the police chief and the mayor.
Yeah.
Is completely like
yeah,
this would never happen now, or almost certainly,
yeah,
never happen now. We can get into that a little bit more later, but like, I don't know, that this was a wild one for me because I really didn't know what to expect, but I look forward to talking about it with you because I feel like it's going to be very illuminating, even the very, very small amount of things that that I found out just from watching this movie and then very quickly like Wikipedia-ing like certain actors. Actors in the sense of actors in the events,
yeah,
not actors,
yeah,
in the movie.
I mean, what is crazy is that the story itself is like, in many ways, there's times where you think like, it has the feeling of like, oh, that probably didn't happen. That was probably contrived to move the plot forward.
Mm-hmm.
And yet most of the crazy stuff, the wilder parts of it did in fact happen.
Yeah. That's my understanding is that this movie is actually pretty like, I wouldn't be surprised if there were certain things that were tidied up to make for a better narrative, but all the wildest stuff, all the stuff that seems like it would be fictionalized or whatever is like, no, that's just what happened, essentially.
Yeah. And I mean, the big piece of it, you know, is sort of the final sequence of the movie, which is that in the final sequence of the movie, the coal miners ambush the mercenaries. And it's as the mercenaries, you know, have assembled, basically, that, you know, for most of the film, you see them, only a couple of agents in town, you know, threatening, using violence, but for the most part, it's just a couple of villains who are portrayed magnificently.
Yeah.
Like the two Pinkerton mercenary thugs are portrayed so well. That guy, the sort of the boss of the two of them, like, that guy deserves, he just does it so well.
I do. We'll structure this. We'll talk a little bit about, I want to talk a little bit about the movie itself, the cast in particular. And then we can explain a little bit, like, this is one of those movies where we need to go through the plot point by point. Like, it's, I think just a brief summary, which I'll allow you to do because you're more familiar with the movie. I know I usually do them, but I'll let you do it this time. And then we can talk a little bit about the sort of historical context of it or whatever. But the cast in this movie is unbelievable. Like,
they're so good.
It's such a great group of actors at really interesting points in their career. Like, this is one of those movies where there's a lot of, I wouldn't say, you know, there aren't really any like A-list actors in it, except for, I mean, James Earl Jones at a time.
Yeah.
Was a pretty fucking big deal. And James Earl Jones was probably at the time that this movie was made, the most famous actor in the movie. It's a great collection of like character actors to very respected, you know, not A-list actors, but I wouldn't want to describe them as like B-list actors or even B-plus-list actors either. Like, the kind of actors that you're aware of are a movie buff. Like
you wouldn't necessarily know Bob Gunton's name, but you see Bob Gunton's face and you're immediately like, oh, that guy.
You know him. Yeah, believe me, you know him. And this is, I have a few, like, I wouldn't even really say they're complaints or critiques. They're just like things that interfered with my enjoyment of the movie that I don't think necessarily reflect poorly on the movie. It's just my, you know, my experience watching it. And one of those things was, so Bob Gunton, for those of you who are like scratching your head wondering who this guy is, I think the role that he is best known for, and I know I've seen him in a bunch of stuff, but
gotta be Shawshank.
Immediately the thing I think of is he's the warden in Shawshank Redemption, which came out about 7 years after this movie. So he was not as established yet as an actor. And that movie I know was pretty big for him, and he made a career on playing that type of guy after it. Like a very, very character actor playing like villains, but a very specific type of villain. Not the sort of like brawny, brutal, you know, sort of not a Bill Sykes type. Or like not that type of psycho, not like a violent, a volatile kind of villain. More like your extremely cold, sociopathic, calculating, almost like the bookish nerd villain.
Weasley, Weasley,
and
plays Weasley villains.
One thing that I think like was, and I mean, granted. And because they cast Bob Gunton, like, I'll give them credit, for doing this. Like, they do reveal quite quickly that he is in fact a snitch and he's a total turncoat. Like he's a he is a mole in the union for the Baldwin Felts Detective Agency, for the coal company.
Yeah.
But he is revealed as that relatively quickly. But but I will say, like, from my 2023 vantage point watching it, I was immediately like, this guy's a turncoat.
Yeah, don't trust this asshole.
Yeah.
yeah. I will say, so a funny note on that before we just walk through the plot quickly is that, interestingly, you know, two of the main characters are him and Chris Cooper's character, who is, I think, the protagonist. But Chris Cooper plays the most straight ahead. Like, he's absolutely the hero. If there is a hero of this film, it is him.
And this is the next person I really wanted to talk about. Yeah.
Yeah. And what's so funny about that is that I don't think since then, I don't think I have seen him. And he's been in a lot of things. You may not recognize his name, but again, you would immediately recognize his face. But he plays villains. He became almost immediately thereafter typecast
I wouldn't say immediately thereafter. I would I would say it's taken longer, but it's a thing that has really been the case.
Oh yeah, like recently, I just think of him. Know? I just think of him as like he's an oil executive in
the Muppets.
Syriana.
And that's hilarious.
Yeah, that too.
Because I haven't actually seen Syriana, so that makes sense. I really want to. By the way, I've always wanted to see Syriana.
We should do that one. It's a good one.
I bet we should. That makes perfect sense. I always think of him when you say oil exec. I'm like, oh yeah, the Muppets.
That's so funny. Which of course, really that funny. That too. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
But I mean, he's also like he plays creeps. He plays racists.
Yeah.
He's
definitely
he's the shitty homophobic closeted guy in American Beauty.
Best part of American Beauty, by the way.
Oh, totally. I mean, he's such an incredible actor that he does an amazing job of making you really hate him in most movies.
I kind of would like how I think of Chris Cooper is I've always thought of him as more than necessarily like not necessarily a villain, but an older actor playing an older man who is always the commonality rather than like whether or not he's a good or bad guy, like a protagonist or an antagonist, is the older man with the gruff exterior, kind of.
Yeah.
And that can go in a few different directions, because the first movie that I saw Chris Cooper in, funnily enough, I remember really liking it as a kid, and I wonder if it holds up, is Seabiscuit. He's the old horse trainer in Seabiscuit.
Seabiscuit.
I will say, I feel pretty strongly like the best of the horse movies, like the horse race movies, you know, because they've made a few of them. And
there's a lot, yeah.
And I feel like that one is really like the most interesting.
Yeah.
Because it has the most interesting people involved. But yeah, like I'm trying to think of what else I've seen Chris Cooper in besides that in American Beauty, the Muppets.
He is also in The Horse Whisperer, actually.
Oh, that is funny. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're right. He was in The Bourne Identity. I think he's a bad guy in that too. Adaptation he was in, which is another movie I haven't seen.
That's a great movie. Oh, it's such a good movie.
He plays the Lieutenant Colonel in Jarhead, which is actually, I don't know if you've seen that, but that is a movie I really want to do, because it's not a a very highly rated war movie. It's not a war movie that is like beloved far and wide by critics or audiences. But I think I thought it was brilliant, and I thought he was very good in that. It's a fairly minor role, but. And then, he was also in The Town. I can't remember who he was in that, but this is exactly the thing, is he's just like one of those guys who you're like, oh yeah, he was in that. One thing I will say is this is totally against type for what he would do later on, because like he is almost never like the star billing guy. Like,
no,
he's almost always the like fourth most famous person in every movie.
Yeah.
Right? Like, and usually playing like an a some kind of authority figure. And I don't necessarily mean like, obviously we've mentioned like oil execs and like military guys or whatever, but that can also just mean like a father figure to someone but yeah, he's definitely like not ever really the type of guy that he is in this movie, which is the, like, he is a classic hero in the in the great like American tradition of, he feels like a character almost out of like a Henry Fonda or a Jimmy Stewart movie.
He's like the strapping American handsome lead in that movie. And it's consistent, and it's done well. Like the scene where he's playing catch with the kid but it's just, it is so, I mean, I really like Chris Cooper as an actor. I think he's really good, but for me, it's like, it's actually very rewarding, even though this is such an early film, but to see him get to be like that kind of a role when I'm used to just seeing him as like this sneery, he's always got a sneery face.
Yes, absolutely. You know? Yeah.
Right. So yeah, I appreciate that for him.
And he is perfectly cast in this, I think, because he has, okay. Well, one thing that I have to mention that just totally blew my mind about this is that Chris Cooper, this is his first film role, and he had his first television role in the same year. So this was brand new Chris Cooper. Like, I don't know if he had done theater before or commercial acting or whatever. Like, I assume this wasn't the first time he ever acted. That would be kind of nuts. But his very first film role, he had his very first TV role in the same year. I don't know, a little earlier or a little later, I'm not sure. But he was 36.
Yeah.
So his film career began at 36 years old, which is wild, honestly, for him.
There's hope for us, Jackson.
It really is, like, it really was like, oh man, oh thank God, that makes me feel, because the thing about that too is it's like there are plenty of people who you go like, oh yeah, don't feel bad, you know, they were this old when they got started or whatever, but they're usually like kind of either they were just losers and that's like, you know, and it's like a redemption story, or they exist in some sort of, like, I can think of a lot of musicians who didn't get famous until they were like 35 or didn't get successful, but they're usually of the sort of like slacker variety where like you kind of, they always seem younger.
Yeah.
Like they always seem way younger. They always seem like, it's like, oh yeah, like, you know, this, I can't think of a good example, but like such and such musician who's like 44, but seems like he would be like 28, other than just the fact that he looks old.
The National, they were like in their late 30s when they got big.
There you go. That's a great example. But the thing with Chris Cooper is that like Chris Cooper arrived as an actor, as an adult man playing adult men, and has pretty much since like been an old guy in movies, which makes sense.
And continues to be. I was just looking while you were talking. He was in Greta Gerwig's Little Women only a few years ago.
That's right.
He continues to be a bankable, versatile character actor.
He just won an award for like being on a TV show, I believe.
Oh, yeah?
A Western, which totally.
That suits him.
That's his kind of... And actually, this movie is almost a Western.
Yeah,
like in how it's structured, and it's and you know, like, I mean, it's too the period it depicts is too late to be a classic Western, but it has a lot of the same.
It does,
feel to it, and it really feels to me like a movie that I could very easily picture being like an early talkie, like having, like, this movie could have been made 10, 15 years after the events that happened. And it could have starred, like, it could have been in black and white, and it could have starred like Henry Fonda or something. And it would have been like largely the same in a lot of ways, which is something that I mean, about it. Like,
if it's got the Western formula of, you know, stranger rides into town and, you know, conflict is brewing within the town and the stranger is intervening in some way and influencing the events of this, you know, sort of inevitable conflict in the town. And what's cool about it is that, you know, those are usually, most Westerns had pretty shitty politics. It was usually just about, you know, white people getting the land. And
yeah, generally there are, right? there are exceptions.
Oh, but, there are. But yeah. And some of them are really standout exceptions for that reason. But yeah, generally that's the formula. But so, you know, this is like a Western about working class organizing and union organizing and like the labor battles of that era in the Appalachians. And it's cool. It really works.
Yeah, no, it's great. And just another, like a couple other like very quick casting notes. David Strathairn as Sid Hatfield. Sid Hatfield, we're going to have to talk about at some point. Always like Strathairn. Very much a guy who is very similar to the Chris Cooper mold. You've seen him in a million things. I think, like, as far as starring roles go, probably best remembered as Edward R. Murrow in Good Night and Good Luck. Another movie that might be worth doing at some point.
Mm-hmm.
Strathairn is just one of those guys who he really, I wouldn't say, has a ton of range. He really is kind of the same guy in every movie. Even his take on Sid Hatfield is pretty the same. But he's always a very reliable, like, quiet, stern, pensive, older gentleman of, you know, various different shades. And it was funny seeing him in this as well. Again, like, it's not being cast against type because it's too early for him to have a type, but I do love these movies where you watch them and you look around and you're like, all these actors, and of course it's not all of them, but it's a lot of them where you're just like, oh man, all these actors like went on to do bigger and better things after this. Like, I love that. Like, that's a thing I always love about, you see this a lot in like, 90s sort of 90s movies, like critically acclaimed ensemble cast 90s movies like Boogie Nights, where it's like, if you watch Boogie Nights now, you're like, every actor in this movie is an A-list like star actor, even to the point of like John C. Reilly, where that didn't happen for another like, you know, over 10 years or whatever. I love when that happens, when you watch a movie and you're just like, holy shit, every person in this movie is famous. And this is like not the highest level of that, but it's got a lot of great like actors who became more famous later on, and a lot of great like, oh hey, it's that guy.
Well, and the most, I mean, in some ways, like the best example of that is that one of the main characters is played by a teenaged Will Oldham. So long before he became Bonnie Prince Billy, you know, famed, sort of punk folk Americana musician, you know, darling of the indie scene from like 2008 to the present. He was this nerdy, corny kid who plays a very, very important role in the movie and absolutely nails it. Like, I think Chris Cooper carries the film, but Will Oldham's character is actually at the heart of it. And his character is the reason that you in many ways care as much as you do.
It's kind of I would almost like, I don't have a perfect thing to compare it to, but it's almost like, picture the River Phoenix, Will Wheaton dynamic in Stand By Me. but River Phoenix is an adult, whereas Will Wheaton's still a child. If that movie existed, that would be the dynamic of this movie, where it's like you have a device where the, and it's not revealed until the end, but you have this device where there's a very clear protagonist. He is the charismatic center of the movie who drives the events. And then you have another character who is very close to the action, but not driving it in the same way, who is narrating the action, like who's the narrator, who's the center of the story. So you have that sort of weird, like almost sort of dual protagonist thing where there's the protagonist, but then there's the person whose point of view the movie is from.
And you know what, we were talking about Westerns.
Yes.
That also harkens to the Western. I was
yes, I was, it's very Shane.
Shane, right? I was thinking recently about how much I remember being in grade 7 and I had to read Shane in English, and I fucking hated that book.
That's funny. So much. I did not read the book. I only saw the movie as
the
like,
movie,
as a kid.
Of course. Yeah.
Yeah. Which I like that movie. I don't. It's very. It's the Western. Like, yeah. And yeah. I did always like it's as far as tropes go, it's got a lot of great tropes. Like. And it sets in place a lot of great tropes, like the guy who I do love the trope of the guy who's like, I don't want to kill nobody, you know, like, just being like, don't make me like, I'm that. And then just like the earliest version of the Bugs Bunny meme where he's holding the gun that says, Lord help me, I'm back to the old me. Like, that comes from Shane. Shane is the original version of that. Yeah. And this movie kind of, this movie is a bit like that in the sense of it has that, like, you know, the stranger that rolls into town. But the difference is that, like, Chris Cooper's character is never succumbs to violence. That's not.
He does not. Yeah.
Who he is. Yeah. And a couple other good ones here. Josh Mostel as the mayor. Josh Mostel is the son of Zero Mostel. He played Tevye in Fiddler on the Roof. Yeah. His son Josh is another character actor. Like, he's a character actor, and the role he plays is fat Jewish guy, basically. That's what his deal is. You know him from such movies as Billy Madison. The Basketball Diaries. Kind of one of those early Adam Sandler guys. Like, he was in Big Daddy as well. Very likable, kind of just guy that you'll see and be like, oh, where have I seen that guy before? And then the last one that I wanted to mention is, you mentioned Hickey, who is the sort of ringleader of the Pinkertons, the Baldwin Felts guys. And this is a deep pull, because I was trying to figure out, like, I'm like, I have seen this guy before. 1,000%, I know I've seen this guy before. And I was trying to figure out, why do I know this guy? And he was the cuck husband in What's Eating Gilbert Grape.
Wow.
Holy. Have you seen What's Eating Gilbert Grape?
Not in years. Okay, I don't remember it very well.
I really like that movie. It's a good movie. It's not the kind of movie we could really talk about on this show, but like... it's very, anyone who ever like grew up in a small town, I think, will like relate to it in a very deep way. But one of the, like, there's a number of like side plots that all kind of merge into each other in that movie. And one of them is that Gilbert is like, you know, he's like a 20 something, you know, stuck in a small town, never went to college, never left home, you know, probably like early 20s. And he's having an affair with Mary Steenburgen, who is like 20 years older, has two, like, you know, not like teenage kids, but like, you know, like a 9-year-old and an 11-year-old or so. She's having an affair with this like grocery clerk who like delivers groceries to her house or whatever, you know, played by Johnny Depp. Her husband is the guy who plays Hickey in this movie. Man. I believe it's pronounced Kevin Teig. Is that right? Let me just. Yeah, Kevin, it's a strange spelling of a last name. I think it's Kevin Teig. He's great in that movie, and he's great in this movie.
It's actually, it's funny that he is not the one that we're talking about who had like a long storied career playing
it's
villains.
True. Yeah, yeah.
Because he is so good. Like, as I was watching it, I was thinking, you know, in some ways, like, he's a cartoon villain. Mm-hmm. And at the same time as he's a cartoon villain, he is utterly not a cliche.
No.
None of the things that he does are cliched. Mm-mm. Even though they are over the top cartoonishly villainous.
Evil. Yeah.
And you know, and it's this controlled, contemptful, smug villainy that actually perfectly captures the ruling class. Like,
so smug. He has the most punchable face of almost any actor I've ever seen in any movie.
And what makes it land so well is that, I mean, if you've ever been involved in any kind of political struggle where there's you know, a group of people that have a significantly like disadvantaged position, structural position, and then some guy that that wields like way more power than he should. That is exactly what they are like. That is 100% a type. You yeah. know, that's like a shitty, sleazy slum landlord, you know, and the tenants are organizing against him. Like he has that energy. Like he just plays it so well. And yeah, so it's funny that he did not end up being like, you know, this well-known stock villain actor.
It is true. Like I could also very easily, like if he could do a good accent, like he would make a great foppish, like British aristocrat. Which is actually like the first thing, like when I was first watching it, I was like, have I seen this guy play like a stuffy old like British guy in something? Like, is he an American actor or is he a British actor? And no, I just realized like, oh no, the thing I've seen him in is Gilbert Grape. which hilariously is like, if you watch Gilbert Grape, he is like a guy who should be one of the most sympathetic characters in the movie, because he's just a guy who, you know, the crime that he has committed is like being boring, and so his wife wants to like fuck a younger guy or whatever, and yet he plays him in this way where he is just utterly like contemptible and just off-putting. And it's really interesting. Like he's very good in this. I would have loved to have seen him in more stuff. I don't know why wasn't, because you know, Gilbert Grape and this movie were both like critically acclaimed, like very critically acclaimed. They're not movies that did particularly well at the box office, but I'm kind of surprised that he wasn't able to kind of lock down a more consistent career as a character actor, just playing like assholes.
Yeah,
but I think that basically covers all the casting stuff that I wanted to talk about. So why don't you just very briefly kind of, and you can weave in whatever, you know, secret knowledge that you may have about the subject matter as well in doing this, but why don't you just very briefly kind of summarize the plot? And it doesn't have to be that detailed, I don't think, because it's general, like the story is very, it's not hard to follow. Like it's not
It's quite straightforward. And what's interesting is that most of what I remember when I think back on the film, I've seen it several times now, but but early on, like the things that stuck out are many of the things that are actually established early on. I mean, one of the most interesting things about the film is what it does with race the working, you know, basically the relationship between different groups of working class people, you know, racialized in different ways, pitted against one another, and you know, the profoundly difficult struggle of making the working class not be racist, and what it means to overcome racism as the working class in order to struggle as a class together. So you know, the film opens with this conflict already having started between the coal miners and the company. Obviously,
and this was very interesting because I couldn't figure out what was happening in the first scene at first. Right?
I know, because you start so deep into it.
Exactly. And I thought for sure that what was happening was that these were strike breakers, or that there was a case of like, you know, like in Grapes of Wrath or something, where it's just these thugs that are just like, here's $50, go beat up these like striking workers.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Not even like organized strike breakers, just like poor disenfranchised thugs that you pay off one time to like just go beat a bunch of people with baseball bats.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But it's not. That happens, certainly.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. I was
that
gonna
is
say,
a
yeah,
thing
which
that
does
happen.
Happen.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
But in this case, it's not. What happens is, you know, you open with these white workers at this coal mine on strike, you know, obviously coal mining being horrifically dangerous work. And the movie does allude to the fact that many people have already died in the mines. There's a lot of widows. There's a lot of like kids that don't have dads because they died in the mines. And, you know, but we open with this strike already basically happening, and the company in the very like, I think like the second or third scene in the movie, the company is bringing in scabs. They're bringing in replacement workers so that the mine operations can continue. And they are all black and Italian. And
yeah, the Italians play a pretty serious role in this as well, which is very funny and very, you know, anachronistic to our time.
Yeah, but I like it.
It's great. Absolutely.
Yeah, they lean into that because it is an interesting reminder of the way that race changes.
Yeah,
and exactly. And who is white and who is black changes. And in that moment, Italians are like kind of more black than white, but still more, you know, still whiter than the blacks. Like there
totally.
Is this,
yes,
this racial hierarchy that is always in motion.
They occupy kind of a similar place in society that I would say, like, to my experience, what I would compare it to is like the role of like South Asians now, where it's like,
yeah, that's fair.
You're more white than black people, but you're not close to being white. Like, you're not nearly like you are. Okay, calm down. Like,
it's a fragile whiteness. You know, fragile.
Yeah, exactly. Like,
yeah,
it's you are defined in relation to, you are still defined as being less than the protagonist race of history. Like, but you're relegated to one of the sort of, you know, like serf class races that is allowed to, you know, the sort of, like another comparison would be like the Slavs in Europe, where it's like, well, you're not the clear like pariah. You're not occupying the pariah caste of people, but you are not like, you will never, at least at the time, the perception is like, you will never be one of us. You will never be brought in, like kind of one level below Irish. Which is kind of, they're going through a similar thing at this time as well.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think in North America, both the Irish and Italians are the sort of, you know, clearest examples of that process of, you know, sort of moving in different places in the racial hierarchies. And I mean, all of this illustrates the stupidity of racism and the stupidity of race as a category,
as an
right?
idea,
the very fact that so much of our life is shaped by race. And, you know, specifically, you know, race is like not even ethnicity. Race, when we talk about race, we're really just talking about relationship to whiteness. Where do you fall on the whiteness scale, you know? And you say pigmentation, and yet race is so dumb that it's not even that.
It's not that,
It's totally socially determined rather
than... It is, because not to, like, digress too far or whatever, but, like, I remember being a really little kid, like very little. No one is ever like pre-racial, I guess. That's not a thing that can happen. But like before I was aware of race as a concept or racism as a concept, which is like a thing that I, you know, when I was like 5 or 6 years old, I had to be sat down and have it explained to me, basically. Right. I remember just thinking like, that's a guy who's that's a woman who's like, she's a totally different color from like me or whatever. But that was like it, right? Like it was literally just a thing of like, oh, that's like a different way to look. It was the same thing as being like, if you see a guy with like green hair, you know, and you're like, oh, I've never seen a person with green hair before. It's just like a characteristic. It's only through, you know, several layers of historical economic context it becomes like something other than that, something other than just like a difference in appearance.
It's a great example of the way that something utterly fictitious, utterly made up, becomes extremely real and it is given extraordinary power. And so the film does a great job of this, right? Because in many ways, you know, it and this is made in 1987, when the transition in terms of Italians, you know, that transition has mostly happened already. And so to include that and to keep it as prominent in the film as they do, it's clear that the film is trying to say, this race stuff is pretty dumb. And yet also extremely real. One of the realest parts of the film is that the protagonist, and I'll explain how this plays out in a second, but the protagonist is trying to get these workers to overcome racism. And in many respects, he fails. I mean, he succeeds in some ways, but he also fails.
Yes.
It's a mixed, you know, outcome. And I mean, here we
are.
Which
is pretty much the way to describe the entire events of the movie, is that it's a mixed outcome.
Totally. Totally. Yeah. So, okay. So, scabs arrive. These workers who've been hired to replace the striking white workers. They are all black. Yes. And James Earl Jones is a prominent, figure among them. They're let off the train outside of town because the company is trying to avoid a confrontation with the white workers, but the white workers already knew, so they come out of the hills and start a brawl with these black workers. So right away, we know that there is this conflict playing out. Also arriving on the same train is Joe Kenahan, IWW, International or Industrial Workers of the World, organizer, labor guy, union guy. He is coming to town to try to help navigate the strike, link the striking workers up with the rest of the IWW.
He is coming into town explicitly as a union organizer.
Yes, that is his role. He is there to connect with the workers and help them coordinate this strike. And in his first meeting, he is there when James Earl Jones shows up as a representative of the black workers and says, we want to be part of the union. I mean, that whole scene is incredible. That scene in that, I think it's a store that they're actually in, but this whole scene where these workers are talking about both their working conditions, why they want to go on strike, the fact that scabs have been hired, James Earl Jones shows up and says, we want to be in the union. Of course, most of the white workers are racist. There are slurs flying, right? Joe Kenahan then gives the speech that, I joked that that's me to my students, but I mean, I do. I give the speech to my students all the time about how, as a class, working people, we are duped by racism constantly, and we constantly give management more power by letting ourselves be divided, by letting ourselves be distracted by bullshit racism instead of focusing on the bosses, the real enemy. And that's the speech
you're familiar with the cookie metaphor, right? Like the old metaphor where it's like there's three men sitting at a table. One of them has 99 cookies. One of them has one cookie. And the guy with the 99 cookies says to the guy with the one cookie, "Hey, that immigrant next to you is going to take your cookie."
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You know, we are very familiar, I think, on the left anyways, if you're familiar with these kinds of things, you're going to be familiar with this speech. It's the speech that a lot of people give various versions of it. How sort of leftist tinged they are changes over time and in context and stuff. But, you know, this is a speech that Eugene Debs has given a version of this speech. I mean, Martin Luther King gave a version of this speech. Even like lesser figures than that, even like Jesse Jackson and Bernie Sanders have given versions of this speech to varying degrees. And it's the point is always the same, which is that, like, if you see yourselves as black people and white people, and obviously, like, this is, it's very, like, I'm oversimplifying or whatever, but, like, if you see yourselves as black people and white people or Italians or, like, this or that or the other, rather than as workers, you will be divided by your differences instead of united by the things that make you, in many respects, the same. You have way more in common with each other than you do with, I think Chris Cooper says very, very brilliantly, very poignantly, there are only two types of people who work and people who don't.
Yeah.
And obviously, especially nowadays, that's it's a little bit more complex than that. But in the realm of a workplace, it is 1,000% correct. There are two types of people at a workplace, people who work and people who don't.
Yeah. I mean, in the big picture, I don't even think it's out of date at all. I think it's still 100% accurate. There's people who work and there's people who profit off those workers' labor.
And there's also an increasing group of dispossessed people who do neither. essentially.
Sure. Okay.
So that's
okay,
the
that's
sort
fair.
Of that's sort of the where you could run the risk of oversimplifying a little bit, but
okay, yeah, I take that. I'll take that.
But that's my only point there is just that like there is an off ramp of being so workerist that you start to kind of ignore like people who are disabled or like yada 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 or whatever. And so I just wanted to pay a little bit of lip service to that. But
no, a point absolutely 100% taken. It remains a great speech. Like it remains for me just like a phenomenal, you know, I have assigned this film in courses because I think it is a perfectly articulated kind of thing. And then, I mean, I think what the film does so well is that it then proceeds to never fully realize any of the things that this speech proposes. Mm-hmm. It comes close at times. There are signs that it could work out. Mm-hmm. But the workers remain dogged by racism at different times and in different ways. That, you know, sometimes they overcome it, sometimes they don't. So, okay, the other important thing that it comes out in that moment is that one of the people who's involved with the union, interestingly, he's clearly not a worker. He clearly has never been in a mine, mm-hmm. but he is part of all the conversations. He's always there. He seems to be among the leadership. Mm-hmm. I think we're meant to understand that he had some kind of a store in town. He was some kind of a small petty capitalist in town because his store burns, is arsoned at the end of the film, which rules.
Absolutely.
But he is also there. He has won the trust of the workers and he's part of these meetings. And, you know, he consistently seems to be making suggestions that on the surface seem okay.
Yeah.
And yet you got this feeling of like, I don't know. Like in that particular scene, he's basically saying like, I think we need to get some guns and we need to like start a gun war against these scabs. And, you know, Kenan is like, no, we should invite them in the union and be a stronger union as a result.
Sort of the complete, perfect, bizarro world, like mirror image of, all the names are like escaping me right now. The snitch in Judas and the Black Messiah, who's just both the actor's name and the real guy's name are just escaping me at the moment, which
it's
is really
Lakeith Stanfield.
Lakeith Stanfield, thank you. That was for some reason I could not remember his name. Despite wonderful actor, I really like him. He's playing the same role, but for in terms of like what he is doing, he's doing exactly the same thing. Like, be more radical when it's totally impractical. Don't be radical at all when it is practical. Like, just essentially, like, the mole in the operation, just trying to be a wrecker, just trying to steer it in the direction of destruction. But the difference is that, like, whereas Lakeith Stanfield is, like, totally coerced, and this was a movie that I thought about a lot while I was watching, this one as well. He is not coerced. This is what he does. Like, this is his job. He's ideologically committed. He's ride or die. He is not being coerced. He is not being, he is the villain of the movie, really. He's the main villain. Like, and it is interesting that, to the best of my knowledge, like, the ownership of the coal company is not depicted.
No, I don't think so.
It's all on the ground. The conflicts are all between, really, people of basically the same class. I think, you know, the character's name is Charles E. Lively. He's a real guy. It's like you said, he is, I guess, sort of a petty capitalist. So he is sort of the one guy in the movie who isn't really like a working class guy necessarily, but like pretty much everyone in this movie is either working class or, you know, not explicitly a rich person or even a person with like necessarily like middle class money, but just a straight up like shill for the capitalist class. Like,
yeah, even those Pinkertons, you know, I think certainly the main guy, you know, seems like he's been doing this for long enough and he's earned some money doing it. And I mean, I think he's certainly better off than any of the working people.
Definitely.
But we also know that he was a soldier in World War One because he gives that creepy speech to the kid. And so, I mean, look, you know, that by itself disqualifies you from being the rich because by that point in the war, the rich weren't fighting in it. Exactly. So, they're all pretty much, it is like different sections of the working class fighting it out amongst themselves. In the last scene, or near the last scene, when the kind of the support arrives for the Pinkertons and the cavalry come in, and there's a group, a gang of maybe like 8 to 10 of them. There is a scene explicitly in there where one guy just signed up. He's clearly, you know, a working class guy who just got this job and doesn't really know what he's up for. And the other two guys are kind of egging him on like, oh yeah, these people are savages. They're going to shoot you in the brain or whatever. And he's scared and he does in fact flee. After that character, after the shootout happens, we see a very brief scene of him fleeing the town by swimming across the river.
He is spared again, by Bonnie Prince Billy.
Yeah, he is spared.
At the end of the movie. Yeah.
Folk legend Bonnie Prince Billy spares the life of...
It's funny. I will add, too, as another note, just while we're on Bonnie Prince Billy, the music in this movie is fantastic. Great period music, great like slide guitar score, and then there's a lot of diegetic music. Like there's a lot of like people in the movie playing music, just like in camps or like in buildings, people singing. It's really that part they really nailed, I thought. They did a really good job of that.
Beautiful scene after I think it's a kid that's been killed. And, you know, the workers are sort of mourning and Appalachian woman just starts belting out an Appalachian folk gospel-y song. And it's like, it's such corny music that it doesn't seem like it should be able to land. And yet in its proper context, it's really powerful.
I love that shit. Like,
the warbly voice. All for it. It's really, it lands so well. And then of course the other thing that's done really well and skillfully, again, corny, borderline corny,
sure,
but in its context works, is that these three groups of workers, they all bring a different type of folk music. This is the 1920s, right? This is long before Elvis has, you know, or anything has coalesced into a kind of singular, hit music.
It's almost 30 years before like Merle Travis.
Yeah, exactly.
Like I was thinking about the song 16 Tons when I watched this, because it's like, that's kind of like, in terms of like a lasting cultural artifact from this period of labor history, 16 Tons is really like the thing, I would think, that like there's that people would still know, that they would still identify. Like, you know, there isn't a lot of stuff, you know, unless you're like a big Billy Bragg fan, I guess, that that's still around, that makes people think about like being a coal miner.
Yeah. Billy Bragg did that album where he sang with Wilco, and they did Woody Guthrie. Unreleased Woody Guthrie.
Lyrics. Yeah. And he did sort of the last big like labor, the sort of end of labor as a thing, the UK miners' strike, right?
Yeah,
he did an EP about that as well.
It's so good.
That's really good. Billy Bragg rocks. My favorite Billy Bragg song, just while we're on the topic, is Between the Wars. I love that song.
Yes. Incredible.
But unless you're sort of into that, like 16 Tons is like a song that I would think, like, even now, like, you might be able to find a teenager, and if you sang the song, they would be like, oh, I've heard that before somewhere. Or whatever. But the thing is that the earliest recording of that song was 28 years after this movie, like, the events of this movie. Like that's how old the music history we're talking about of this movie. Like,
which is why the things that might seem corny to a contemporary audience are actually quite not corny. They're quite
absolutely
in their
necessary
place. And the thing I'm thinking of is these sequences where each of the three different groups of workers have some people who got instruments and they're playing them. They're folk instruments that each of these different folk groups are playing, right? And the Appalachian people are playing violins and fiddles.
Yes.
And, you know, the Italians have, yeah, I think it's like a bouzouki or a mandolin or something.
Yes, sure.
The black workers have the harmonica.
Harmonica.
And,
yeah.
And they all play them together, right? Gradually, one by one, someone's playing and then the others join in. And
which I felt that very deeply.
Me too.
Like I thought that was very like, that's a really great show don't tell.
Yeah. Yeah.
As much as like I could understand people saying like, oh, it's a bit corny or whatever. It's like, no, that is a way better way of depicting the thing that they're trying to depict.
Yeah.
Cause the thing is that the way people try to do this in movies now is just as corny 99% of the time. It's just also, it's corny and wordy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, this is something that they do this without. There's no dialogue.
Yeah.
Like it's just a scene. It's just it happening. And it also just, it connects the events of the movie to the sort of like the folk music history, which is totally tied up in like folk music is labor music, basically.
Yeah. Well,
like it really is. Yeah. Like there's hardly any difference.
Even. And when folk music starts to be called like American folk music, and when it starts to emerge as its own thing, I mean, it's a product of precisely these histories coming together. Mm-hmm. Bob Dylan played an acoustic guitar and a harmonica. That's because these things came together. And so,
it's because Woody Guthrie played an acoustic guitar.
That's right.
Basically.
Yeah.
Right.
Like, so,
God, and Woody Guthrie rocks too.
Yeah.
I'll put that out there as well.
Yeah. Absolutely.
But yeah, I mean, this really is like we're jumping all over the place, but like this really is just the movie.
It is.
It's, you know, the events are set in place by the bringing up the scab or the beating up the scab workers at the beginning, the introduction of C.E. Lively, being the wrecker, being the snitch, the Judas of the whole situation. And really after that, it really just is like there are details, you know, there's a point where it's the most, emotionally, I guess, like intense, highest stakes part. Although also I will say the part of the movie that kind of was the most like convoluted and not working for me part, which is where Lively briefly kind of is able to convince the union that Hanahan is actually the snitch.
Yeah.
And he convinces this woman to like falsely accuse him of sexual assault. But it really is just like the next, you know, hour and a half of the movie is just a very prolonged, like protracted, like Cold War between the Pinkertons and the miners.
Which is
like,
not to say that it's that nothing happens, that there's no plot or that it's boring, because, you know, I forget. Like, I always remember when I think of the movie, I remember the setup. I remember the opening stuff and the basic premise of it.
Yes.
And then I forget those details later. But every time I watch it, it still remains like gripping, and each piece follows from the next. And each, you know, escalation by the bosses or by the Pinkertons, you know, every sort of all the sort of small bits of character development that happen in between, they're all done so well. Will Oldham's character is a preacher in two different Baptist churches. It's a very funny running sort of gag / piece of the story where he is this child preacher in, and he's aware that there's like one of them, one is like a soft Baptist church and one's like a heavy Baptist. And so he like tailors his sermons to each of them. And he, you know, his grandmother is very funny about all of that. She's proud of his preaching.
Yes,
like there's a lot of really, really great character work done in the in-between bits of what is a very nuanced, accurate and skillful portrayal of what a drawn out labor struggle looks like. I've seen like modern versions of pretty much everything with the exception of Shots Fired, but otherwise everything else that is portrayed in that struggle. I've seen it in my own strikes. I've seen all those different characters emerge and, like, in that sense, this feels like a Ken Loach film. This feels the layers and the details and gets them right and lands on the right political line with them in a way that, like, for me is very reminiscent of the best Ken Loach films.
I've never seen a Ken Loach movie. I obviously need to.
Oh my God. Yeah. Yeah. I'm, you have
obviously
to.
Aware that, like, I mean, come on. He's like, obviously I would like,
yeah,
Ken Loach. It's one of those things. It's the same to draw a totally different parallel. It's like John Boys in like 2019.
Yeah.
where I was like, oh yeah, of course I would like, yeah, John Boys. I haven't done the time, yeah, yet. So, you know, maybe that'll be my next obsession.
If you like Matawan, yeah, that's the feel, yeah, of a good Ken Loach film. It's like, it doesn't sacrifice characters. In fact, it does good enough character work that you're invested in them, and your investment in them is why the politics matter, and it's why, mm-hmm, the outcome of the strike matters. These aren't just like empty shell figures,
no,
of different, oh, you know, there's the radical and there's the conservative and there's the moderate or whatever.
Yes.
They're real people, yeah, with contradictory, you know, and complicated personal sort of places within all, mm-hmm, of it. You know, there's a really sympathetic character who is a woman who is a widow. She's the mother of Will,
yes,
Oldham. You know, her husband was killed, presumably like in the mine doing union activism. And so she is, mm-hmm, reluctant about it, but she's also really proud of her son that he's doing it and that he's into it. She's, mm-hmm, she's torn,
yes,
right? And that's real. That's how these things are. These things are not black and white. They are very, very complicated in real life. And my experience of being on strike, and I've been on strike actually several times, and also, mm-hmm, done strike support in many others. My experience, sure, is that you always find that people who maybe didn't know each other super well or were kind of, superficially knew each other, and the things you knew about them were sort of superficial. You find, mm-hmm, out who people are in a strike. People's,
yeah,
true colors,
totally,
come through, and in complicated ways, not just like, oh, it turns out so-and-so's a villain, but it's like, oh, it turns out,
no,
so-and-so is this precise type of villain. You know, so-and-so,
yeah,
is this precise kind of selfish, or, you know, or maybe someone you thought would be kind of selfish turns out to be remarkably capable of solidarity in specific, mm-hmm, ways. Like you learn about people in a way that you really don't otherwise. We have very rarely get to find out what people are really about. And then a strike suddenly shows that. And I think this film did a really good job of that. Like it really.
Yeah, it does, because there are all different types. Because you mentioned this, and because I just mentioned John Boyes, the thing that I think about with regards to that is his brilliant, he did a brilliant like 20 minute, sort of one of the earliest versions of what we see with Dorktown now, called Randall Cunningham Seizes the Means of Production. It's about the 1987, I believe, NFL player strike. Uh-huh. And one of the things that he talks about in it is like, you know, so obviously the NFLPA goes on strike, and Randall Cunningham is like, he's this like, you know, at the time, like a fucking like 22-year-old phenom on track to make $1 billion, like young anointed star, like already established, but also still so young. And his whole vibe at the beginning of the strike is to kind of just be like, I don't know why we're doing it. I don't fucking know anything about this. Like, I'm a football player. I don't know anything about,
yeah,
strikes. Like, why are we doing this? Like, I don't know what any of this,
yeah,
is. But then very quickly, his convictions become, I am a good teammate.
Mm-hmm.
I support my teammates.
Yeah.
And like, that is because I'm a sports guy. Like, that's a thing that I really see and I really think of with when it comes to strikes, or when it comes to like labor action, is like that type of person.
Same.
The type of person who is like not politically sophisticated, but is very dedicated based on a very, very simple moral assessment,
yeah,
or philosophical assessment of like, I am a good coworker.
Mm-hmm.
So I am I support my teammates,
mm-hmm,
essentially.
Yeah.
And I think that is that like instinct is portrayed really well in this movie where,
sorry, I don't mean to interrupt, but yes, but before we lose track of it, I got to pop this in, not to, you know,
no, please,
blend Roxy Fever into this, but
the other day
we, Jax and I are pained, slightly recovering, you know, trying to escape Canucks fans. Quinn Hughes made the comment earlier this season about like being concerned about Tanner Pearson's broken hand and whether it was handled properly by the team. And then Tanner Pearson in his exit interviews this year said he was really grateful to Quinn Hughes for sticking up for him. That showed what a great teammate he was. And it was a great little mini example of the solidarity of being a teammate, but being applied. And I don't think Quinn Hughes is conscious of this, but what Quinn Hughes did subconsciously is apply the concept of like, I'm a good teammate, to a labor issue in which he expressed labor solidarity with Tanner Pearson.
And the point of bringing this up and the point of talking about it is that, you know, it's actually like an extremely Marxist viewpoint on how solidarity is built, which is that like it is not something you read about in a book and then apply. Like oftentimes the best like forms of solidarity occur naturally from the, like, they are an outgrowth of being shoved in a room together with a bunch of different people and being forced to get along.
Exactly. And forced to do something, probably do something shitty and experience something shitty together.
And that is, and that I think is actually portrayed really well in this movie too, because like Chris Cooper, his character is very integral to the events, and he is one, he does move, like meaningfully move the union in certain directions. In a meaningful sense, he does meaningfully organize the workers. They do things like, you know, if he hadn't been there, they might not have accepted the black workers into the union, the Italian workers into the union. Like, he does have a meaningful impact on the organization of the union. But at the same time, it is not just depicted as being as simple as he gave a great speech and then everyone did the thing.
Absolutely.
It is actually like, it is like his power as an organizer is explicitly tied to the fact that he is just the best person at articulating the thing that is already happening to them. And it is the things that happen to them and the events that are actually what move the plot forward. He is there to articulate it and to hone it and to do a better job of organizing it. But ultimately, at the end, he fails.
Yes, exactly. And I'm so glad you brought this up, because now we're really getting into the, for what for me is like the read, the interesting stuff here, because, you know, his character represents, I think, a constant tension for communists, socialists, and labor organizers, people who are not necessarily trying to just, you know, organize in their own workplace with their own co-workers, but who are trying to have the broader vision of, okay, one workplace isolated is not going to cut it. We need to be united at a broader level. We need to build this thing bigger. And there is, and that is an absolutely correct position. One workplace alone is never going to cut it. You know, we absolutely as a class need to be unified as much as we possibly can. And that requires organization by people who are not specifically located in just one workplace. But when you are that kind of person, and I've been that in different ways, as a person who teaches and teaches labor stuff, I am that, right? I am not working at McDonald's with my students. They're telling me about it. I'm giving them tools for how to think about it, but I am not standing there getting burns from the fryer like they are. Their arms are covered in burns. Mine are not, right? I am not in the Amazon warehouse.
That was my life.
Right? Exactly. And when you're in that
job,
that
was my life for so long.
Yeah. When you're in it, you have a certain kind of solidarity that you build with the other people who are in it. And it stops at everyone who is not in it. And so there are these great moments in the film. And even though it's the Wrecker who's doing it, it's the Wrecker who is creating these things. When he plants some seeds of doubt about Joe Kenahan, the labor guy, you have moments where the workers say, you know what? Yep. We're having a meeting, miners only, with the explicit point being, you're not one of us. Get out of the room. We who trust each other, who actually work in the mine, are going to talk. And that is such a real part of trying to build broader struggles of the working class. And as someone who is usually I'm the Joe Kenahan type guy in those scenarios, you're always aware that you can, there's some things you can do to articulate, like you said, to articulate the frustrations people have, to put them in a broader context. But the bottom line is you're not in there with them. And that is always going to quite legitimately undermine your credibility at some level. You're always going to have to, you know, be working on keeping people's trust because you're not literally in the mine with them. So I thought the film did such a good job of showing that.
Yes, yes. So I think at this point we should talk about the ending because that is really like I had such an interesting experience with this movie because as I believe I mentioned, like I watched the first, it's about 2 hours and 10 minutes long, and I watched the first like hour and 45 minutes, and then it was so late I was like I have to turn this off, I'm gonna fall asleep. And so I woke up this morning and watched the very end of it. And like the last 25 minutes are the best part. And that like I turned it off right at the scene. I had to rewind it a little bit. I turned it off right at the scene where they're playing catch.
Mm, yeah, yeah.
Right? Which is sort of like the last normal scene in the movie. Yeah. Like the last like slow like character building scene in the movie. And then everything from that point on is pretty much like breakneck. Yeah. Shit comes to a boil. Yeah. The guy, I guess, in this scenario that I really want to talk about for a second is Sid Hatfield, who is played by David Strathairn. He's the chief of police in the town. And he is like, cause he's a real guy. And I was reading about him and I was just like, this guy is so weird.
Mm-hmm.
Like just like this guy existing. Definitely an example of a guy who is a product of his time, mm-hmm. like a type of guy that cannot exist now.
Mm-hmm.
But fascinatingly, both him and the mayor of the town in this conflict side with the striking workers, and don't just side with them, like side with them very unequivocally, very convincingly,
and with guns,
and in a very and in a very prolonged sense. Like David Strathairn is meaningfully, Sid Hatfield is meaningfully like a thug, but on the behalf of the workers. Yeah. Like he's like a Western sheriff type guy.
Yeah.
But he's on behalf, he's doing it on behalf of the workers, like toting two guns. At a time, dual wielding sometimes.
Oh, yeah, that seems amazing.
And I was reading about this guy a little bit, and Sid Hatfield of the Hatfield and McCoy Hatfields.
Yeah.
Which I didn't realize. And like the Hatfield and McCoy thing is like so confusing to me because it's like, as far as I can tell, you know, that's a big part of U.S. history in a lot of ways. But as far as I've ever been able to tell, the story is just like, yeah, a long time ago, these two families hated each other so much that they killed each other for 30 years. Mm. But, very funny to see him kind of come out of that. Yeah.
Allegedly, it's not, it's not 100% sure that he was.
Sure.
It's
okay.
I mean, I like it if he is.
I think it makes sense for him to be.
Yeah.
And of course, granted, like this is a generation later, because that conflict was three generations ago, basically at the time of the, or started three generations ago by the time of the events of the movie. And then, lasted for a generation, essentially, and then died out over another generation. And then he you know, pops up or whatever as the sheriff. And he is like, yeah, just a fascinating guy. Like him and the mayor, like, died for these work for these miners. Like at the end, at the very end of the movie, as we've alluded to, like, there is just a literal shootout. Like, the Pinkertons all roll into town. Like, they're fucking, you know, I don't know, the such and such gang out of a Western. High Noon. Yeah. It's fucking shootout at the OK Corral. Literally, yeah. It's like,
there's actually
the baddies roll into town and the sheriff's going
to
take them
and
on.
And it's actually, like, again, to draw the comparison with those Westerns, the when the Pinkertons arrive and sort of, you know, they're here, they're rolling in, they're all walking on the stones along the railroad tracks. So there's a great scene where they're all walking towards the camera on the railroad tracks, and they're kind of spread out walking like this little mini paramilitary, you know, unit. And it's very much like a Western gang rolling into town, and it, and yet it's set in West Virginia in the coal mines. And so it's on the railroad tracks rather than, you know, like main street of the town.
It's a fantastic scene. It's great. Like, it really is one of those classic, like, they're staring each other down. And then I can't quite remember, but there's a moment where essentially, like, somebody flinches, somebody moves. Is it because Kenahan is, like, kind of runs into the scene that the first shot is fired?
I don't know.
Like,
I would have to watch it again to find out. Kenahan has discovered that this is about to happen. And he has, you know, we didn't mention this, but he has been throughout the film, respectfully trying to keep the workers from initiating any, like, armed struggle.
Violence.
Because, you know, keeps sort of making the point that, like, everyone's watching these things and the state would love it if you guys shoot someone so they can justify sending in troops. So you gotta be smart about this. And yet,
it's from a very practical, like, viewpoint.
It is.
Like, because I was watching it and I was kind of thinking, like, are they trying to make him like this nonviolent guy, like a, you know, sort of, not that, you know, I mean,
yeah, I know,
I don't want to completely poo-poo nonviolence. Like, nonviolence is a tactic. It's not a philosophy. Yeah. That's what I'll say about it. Right. But I was watching it and I'm like, oh, are they trying to, like, make this guy sort of like a Christ figure, like, you know, like this like nonviolent guy or whatever. But if you really listen to what he's saying, like, it seems pretty consistent. It's not that he is opposed to armed struggle because he is opposed to armed struggle. He's opposed to armed struggle because it is impractical. Yeah. Like, because based on where they are at in the struggle, they don't have anything to gain by turning violent.
Exactly.
They only have things to lose.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it's a tactical thing.
If we fight them on their terms, we'll lose. Yeah. We got to make them play our game.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, bring back the sports metaphors for a second. So, you know, regardless, I think it is kind of a little bit meant to be ambiguous what exactly causes it to happen. A massive shootout begins. And I believe it is the mayor who takes the first shot.
The mayor eats it early on,
which is, again, funny. Yeah. Like, a funny thing to imagine. The mayor gets owned immediately, and then David Strathairn just fucking blows the heads off these two guys with it, dual wielding, like, magnums. Yeah. Like, I don't know what gun it actually is, but they're magnum looking. They're
revolvers that
have the fucking pointy ass like sight.
He's
on
even
the end
at one at one stage he's doing the thing, he's dual wielding, but he's also doing the thing where, like, the unnecessary and probably impractical thing where, like, he sort of pushes one arm forward to shoot and then pushes the other arm forward to shoot, and he's like I'm miming it here. It's probably, I don't know if it's coming across, but it looks so fucking cool when he's doing it.
It's great. It is great. Like, the thing that I'll give them is, like, this movie, there's probably ways that it could have been more, there's ways that it could have been a better, maybe, entertainment product. There's ways that it could have been more, like, maybe a more compelling movie or a more, like, compelling story, or, like, have more, like, style or verve. But I think all of those ways would have come at great expense to how didactic it is. And so the thing that is so great about this scene is how earned it is.
Totally.
Like, it's like when it finally boils over and you get like the one kind of Western, like action movie scene, it comes across as just so based. You've watched this, like, you know, heartfelt, like almost like melodrama of, like, you know, just the struggle between, like, the internal struggle between the workers, like, themselves, which is largely what it is, like, sort of just punctuated by these little moments of intimidation by the Pinkertons. There's a great scene where the Baldwin Felts guys have dinner with the little boy preacher and his family, and then end up pointing a gun at him. Which is a really good, like villain scene from them. But like when it finally boils over into the action sequence or whatever, it goes pretty hard. And it's it doesn't like pull any punches. Like there's a shot of a guy's kneecap just getting split open. Like it's good. I was like, damn, I was not expecting it. Like,
I know.
I was really expecting them to go subtle with it, and they didn't. And I'm really glad that they did.
And it was
awesome.
Like, yeah, it makes for just like a really exciting sort of climactic scene. But it also still for the purposes of the film, it manages to do something really good, really clever, I think, which is that, you know, you're not really ever convinced that it was the right call. You don't necessarily come away for as much as there's something. And this scene comes right after the immediate sort of like motivation for them to launch this ambush is that a young kid, coal miner, is murdered really brutally. Yes.
Oh God.
Horrible scene that Will Oldham's character overhears, where he's, you know, being tortured.
Evil.
Yeah. Totally evil.
Truly evil.
Give me the names. Yeah. Give me five names. Under horrible torture, he finally gives up some names and then has his throat slit. It's awful.
Yeah.
And so you really want these guys to fucking get what they deserve. And so
true movie villain shit.
Yeah. So the scene where they do this ambush is very cathartic. You totally understand why they've done it.
But the thing is that in politics, catharsis is bad. I don't want to say it's bad in and of itself.
It's just not,
like,
necessarily strategic.
That we don't. Yeah, I'm not saying like people don't deserve to ever feel catharsis. Like they absolutely do. It can be a very welcome, like, moment of relief. It can be an oasis in the desert. But it is not an end unto itself.
No. And
it is, and in this case, and in a similar case to, like, you know, I would say like a lot of things that we enjoy watching happen politically now, like just the punishment of our enemies or whatever, which is really the only thing left in politics, is Schadenfreude. The only thing left to root for, like this happening it's extremely cathartic. Everybody gets what's coming to them. But you don't get the impression, you don't get the sense that it won anything.
No, absolutely not.
Like that it achieved anything other than just the satisfaction of, and it really is very satisfying. There is the widow that you mentioned earlier, boarding house where most of the workers stay, where Chris Cooper stays initially before moving into one of the camps or whatever. And giving his spot up to, I think, James Earl Jones.
No, he gives up to the two Pinkertons. Yeah.
It is. Yes, that's right. Yes, the main guy, the cuck husband from Gilbert Grape, whose name Kevin Teig. That's the guy. He runs up to the boarding house. He's escaped, and he is like running away like a little bitch, and he's kind of hiding behind some laundry that's out on a clothesline drying, and he's taking aim at someone, and then he just hears a gun cock behind him, and then the boarding house widow just fucking annihilates him with a shotgun blast to the chest.
Yeah.
And it's like it's a great shot where the shot is from behind, so you just see the blood splatter
on the sheets.
And The weird thing is I watched this movie on YouTube and like I would not necessarily recommend watching the free version on YouTube because it's got a few like tech problems. You hear like the Microsoft notification sound going off a couple times. Only a couple times. It didn't really interfere, but the one thing at the end of the movie that kind of sucked is that the audio goes really out.
No, too bad.
With the picture, which is too bad. But in this one scene, it actually kind of worked because there was a like 1 second lag between the sound of the shot and the blood splattering on the, which is actually like more accurate from what I understand to like what a gunshot is actually like. And it was just for me watching it in that like format or whatever, it was very striking to just kind of have the like, the split second, like splat, boom.
Yeah.
Like, it was dope. It was my favorite part, probably, was that, that and the guy getting his kneecap split open were both.
They're super satisfying. And this is why I think it's like, it's such a skillfully, rendered sequence because it is so satisfying. It's so deserved. Every single one of those fuckers gets what they deserved. And, you know, but there is also this palpable sense that this is a Pyrrhic victory, and it start and as the dust settles on the sequence, you immediately feel it because the things as the gun smoke literally starts to subside, the first things that you see are Kenahan has been shot and is dying.
Yes.
Right, the guy who was at the heart of all this and who made all of this possible, or made a lot of it possible, and who knew this was a bad idea. He's on the ground dying. The mother of the kid who was tortured. There's a really striking scene. She's old. She's an old woman. She's got white hair. She's been a minor character, but she's actually part of a really cool scene where she's like racist, basically, and is like being forced out of her racism by this situation and learning to actually be less racist. It's actually very, again, very cleverly done. And then it's her son that is tortured and murdered. And there's this moment where you see her. She's unloading a pistol into the head.
She just keeps shooting this guy's dead
like
body. She fires like six shots. And then Sid Hatfield finally has to like walk over to her and be like, okay.
Yeah. And she like, is like, it's, she it's is done. Disassociating. I mean, she is.
Oh, yeah.
She is not well. And she's just unloading bullets into this guy. And like there's something like that moment isn't satisfying. It's actually horribly upsetting.
Sad.
Right.
Yeah.
You're aware that like she is with every bullet she puts into this guy, she's trying to get her son back and she cannot. And so there's this awareness that like this might have felt right as it was happening, but this was probably a mistake. This was probably short-sighted. And I mean, look, the film is made in 1987. At the height of the Reagan-Thatcher assault on labor. At the moment when everything...
Kind of surprising that it was made at the time that it was made.
True. That's true. But also, really timely in that sense. Because it's about... Yeah. That's labor losing. And you know, it took a long time for the struggles of the 1910s and 20s and 30s to manifest into any real victories for labor. Like there were a lot of losses and a lot of people died in these kinds of fights, and things like the Maidawan massacre justified incredible violence against striking workers and against socialists.
I prefer the Battle of Maidawan.
Thank you. Yes.
Personally.
Yes. Better.
Yeah, I like that better because it was not
agreed.
The massacre is what happened after.
Yes. No, totally.
But it is remembered at the end when it is revealed that, and this isn't a movie with a ton of narration. It's a movie with a little bit of narration at the beginning, a little bit of narration at the end, and I believe like punctuated a couple of times in the middle with some slight narration. It's I actually just watched a movie with this kind of narration in it. Last Temptation of Christ, believe it or not. Which will come up on our next episode. Okay. I think where it's that type of narration where it's like it's there, it's present, it is an element of the movie, but it isn't like Goodfellas. It's not like a voiceover that's constantly happening in the movie. It's very brief, but it is revealed at the end of the movie that the narrator is in fact the little boy preacher, as I keep referring to him as. And it is, this is remembered not as, very interestingly, not as like the culmination of something or the conclusion of something, but as the beginning of something.
Exactly.
Like it is remembered as basically the beginning of, which is not entirely accurate in terms of the kind of traditional historical view on the, you know, it's got a lot of different names, but I think he refers to it as like the Great Coal War or something. Yeah. But it is kind of the beginning of the really violent like clash happening or around coal miners during this period. And I will say, like, one thing that I wish that they could have, they're very focused at the end. They don't do the they don't do the crawl thing that a lot of history movies do. Like, they don't have the, like, you know, fucking the serious version of the Animal House Where Are They Now thing. They do it in voiceover, which I actually kind of like better, I think. But they're very focused on what happens to the individual actors. You know, they talk about how the Hatfield marries the mayor's widow almost immediately, and then later was gunned down in front of the courthouse by C.E.
Which is true.
Lively, which is true.
That is a
100% true. And then it kind of just ends abruptly, which is my one, like, I think probably my biggest complaint about the movie is just like the ending is so good, but it's also so abrupt that I felt like I could have just, I know it's kind of already a long movie, but I felt like I could have just used like five more minutes to kind of like, you know. But having said that, maybe if I watched it again, it would, especially on a better feed or something, maybe it would just feel like stark. And maybe more affecting.
I was gonna say, I kind of think it lands because you're just, you're really left with this sense of what was supposed to be your big positive climax victory is precisely a Pyrrhic victory that ends with a really uncomfortable thud. And it's not that they were wrong morally to do it. It's not that you can't you know, understand why. It's not that you putting yourself in that situation, you might have done the exact same thing. I sure might have. But Joe Kenahan was trying to return, tell them, this is not going
to
end
to return to
right.
The sports metaphor, you play to win the game.
Yes.
Right?
Exactly.
And that is ultimately the way that it ends is like, a little bit of like, we won the battle, but we lost the war kind of thing, which is actually, I will say, like, one thing that, you know, could have maybe been made more clear. And again, like, this isn't necessarily, I'm not so much critiquing it so much as just examining the routes that were not taken, right? That would have that could have been interesting, not necessarily better. Maybe something that could be explored by a different movie. And I want to wrap up pretty soon here, but I will say one thing, like, a Sid Hatfield movie would be really good, I think. Like, someone making a Sid Hatfield, like, that's its own movie that would be really good, I think. Especially because, like, you could say that this story ends, like, more organically with him being gunned down in front of the courthouse. Mm-hmm. I like it from the perspective of being didactic, that it is Joe Kenahan who is the focus and the star of the movie and not Sid Hatfield, for a variety of reasons, not the least of which is that even if he is, like, you know, in a group of like two people ever, along with Christopher Dorner, of like cool police officers, he is a cop. And I think it's very hard at this day and age to make a movie about a hero cop, even if it's one like this, that that doesn't ultimately serve like reactionary interests or whatever. Having said that, though, you could make, I still think someone should make that movie, because even if it does serve reactionary interests, it would be a good movie. The one thing that I kind of wish, just for a couple different reasons, that they would have made more clear is that, like, eventually the United Coal Workers did win meaningful concessions.
Yeah.
In their battle against the bosses, and the most obvious and significant of which is, I mentioned the Sun 16 tons, right? And that is 16 tons is describing a model of a workplace that no longer exists and is no longer legally allowed to exist virtually anywhere in the Western world, which is basically like the way that this period of American labor worked for a lot of people, for a lot of people who worked what you would kind of think of as like the hick jobs, the Okies, the certainly miners, but also like the kind of people that would be the main characters in a John Steinbeck novel or whatever, is essentially this model of a workplace that is legalized chattel slavery, essentially, like where you live in a company town that's owned by the company. You sleep in company beds in a company owned housing, and you are paid essentially in coupons.
Yeah, in company scrip.
Yeah. And so what your life is your boss owns your house, your boss owns all the things that you buy and only pays you in something that is only useful for getting goods from the thing that they own and funnels everything back into the company, essentially. Yeah. And it creates a scenario where people can never leave because they can't save money because they're not paid in money. Like it's the kind of thing that when you describe it, I think a lot of people would have a hard time like believing that existed. Mm-hmm. Like they would be like, no, that's slavery. Like that's not.
And on that point,
they got rid of that.
Yeah. And on that point, the film does such a good job of showing us that in a very quick, effective scene where where the boss is explaining all of this to the workers. And it's especially effective because he's explaining it to the black workers who've just arrived as scabs. And, you know, it's a scene that only takes, you know, a very short time, but in that tiny little sequence as the guy is explaining all of these things, and at some point James Earl Jones actually raises, you know, like a mild concern about it and is basically told like, okay, I've written you down as a problem, really effectively shows how, like you said, you know, these are certainly, you know, it's not slavery, and so having it be the black workers is important to distinguish it, and yet it feels so much like it. There are so many ways in which for a group of workers who would only have had nominal freedom, you know, for the last 50 years at best. Right. And there are references to the Civil War in this film as a reminder that it was not that far back. You know, here they are, you know, at free laborers effectively being treated like slaves again. So it's a really,
exactly
well done scene. And also it comes back throughout the film because part of the power that the company has is that they can just roll into town and evict anyone they want because everything is owned by them.
And that is kind of how Hatfield first figures into the movie is, and the mayor is, they are opposing the evictions basically on the grounds that like this legal gray area of being like, yeah, you own the property, but like this is public land. Yeah. So like, it's like it exists in this weird like gray area where they're able to kind of oppose the evictions because they're illegal, you know? Yeah. And of course, eventually the company finds a way around it, but like it is very interesting. And it's portrayed really well. And the reason why I say like, I understand it's for a movie that's as didactic as it is, like, I think its ending is more justifiable artistically than it is didactically. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean.
Because artistically, I think it's like, oh yeah, okay, Stark, like, he fucking dies and then that's it, basically. Mm-hmm. Like, you get the brief, like, this is what happened from the guy. And then he's like, you know, he basically is like, yeah, this is the prequel to the great coal mine wars or whatever. But the problem with that is that I assume that the audience for this movie doesn't necessarily really know what that is. Mm-hmm. And so if you're not given any context about that, the worry that I have is that the audience for this movie, the intended audience, could mistakenly come away from the movie with the impression that all of this was pointless and that nothing came of it.
Yeah.
And that's not what happened.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And I do think like that this movie portrays very accurately, very importantly, and very meaningfully that like this sort of thing and the approaches that are taken in this movie are often great victories nestled within larger defeats, mm-hmm. or vice versa. Yeah,
totally.
Right. But I do think like that it was an error from an educational standpoint to not make it more clear that like this event, not the battle necessarily, but the organizing that happened was a meaningful step in essentially like actually finally really for real abolishing slavery.
Yeah.
In these kinds of workplaces and these kinds of jobs. And just as an interesting tie-in with the Civil War, as we mentioned before, it's not actually the Pinkertons that are depicted in this movie, but the Pinkerton Detective Agency, the real Pinkerton Detective Agency. Do you know how they got their start?
No.
Like what their first thing was? So they date back to the 1850s or 60s. And they're thing that they, their like main thing that they were known for, it's kind of unexpected. They were kind of like Abraham Lincoln's private bodyguards, and they uncovered a plot, like an initial plot to assassinate Lincoln. And they did a lot of spying on the Confederates.
That's funny.
And a lot of like, they gathered a lot of intel on the Confederates for the Union in the Civil War. And that's kind of how they got their start, which is very funny and very interesting, because I think it shows like it just shows how history moves.
Yeah.
You know, like it reminds me a lot of like, HUAC actually is like a parallel I would draw, where, you know, HUAC was around before the Red Scare, right? Mm. And one of the initial things that people would report to HUAC was actually fascist activity.
Right.
It was actually people who were Nazis in America.
Right.
And it shows you that like the problem with those sorts of agencies or institutions isn't necessarily like the ideology that they're established under. It's how they're organized, how they achieve what they achieve, who they're beholden to, and what they do.
Yeah, especially right? Who they're beholden to, exactly.
Because it's like, you know, the idea of having like a group of private thugs when the president is Abraham Lincoln doesn't seem so bad, because it's like, well, I mean, it's for like they're trying to spy on the slavers, like they're you know, they're fighting for the side that wants to abolish slavery or whatever. Like, how could that be a bad thing? And it's like, well,
yeah,
because everyone else who is president after Abraham Lincoln, pretty much, right?
Yeah.
Like, so I thought that was very interesting. I just learned that today.
One thing, but, thing I want to, because I don't want it to get lost, and it's kind of maybe the last thing that I want to say. I want to respond to what you sort of summed up there about kind of the ending and like maybe the mistaken notion that the film could give you that perhaps like fighting against these bosses was a bad thing, or that it accomplished nothing. And I think you're making a really good point. It's probably the one.
It's more the second one.
Yes.
It's more, not so much that it was a bad thing, but that it was pointless.
Right. And I think that, I think I share that concern, as well. And, you know, the very fact that our main protagonist hero was preaching nonviolence, you know, it's like, well, a lot of the time preaching nonviolence means preaching accepting injustice, and in that sense, like nonviolence as it's usually preached can be pretty reactionary. So I know exactly what you mean, and I want to just say that I think this, it's one of the hardest things to do if you are committed to like socialist realist filmmaking, in the sense that you're committed to like, you know, these values, working class struggle and revolutionary struggle against injustice, but doing it in a really grounded, rooted, realistic, you know, way. Because Ken Loach has had the same problem. And Ken Loach has filmed, and in one in particular, The Wind That Shakes the Barley, which we should do. You should watch it. It's incredible. It's about the Irish struggle against British colonialism. But that film splits at the halfway point. There's an act one and act two. Act one, they're fighting against the British. But act two is when the socialists and the nationalists within Ireland split. The IRA itself gets split.
Right. Okay.
And so act two is this civil conflict between the Irish nationalists who've now taken over and the Irish socialists who are saying, no, this isn't it. This isn't enough. And that film is so bleak and so stark. And in many ways, it ends with this sense of like so much violence has happened and you're emotionally like invested in it. And it's so upsetting. And at the end, you're like, fuck, what was this for? It didn't work. It didn't happen. We didn't win. And I think Ken Loach in that film is like trying to show us why they didn't win. And he's being so realistic about it because he wants you to see, like, he wants you to take lessons for how to struggle better and win next time. But you could easily watch the film. And again, I know because I assigned this to my students and I got a bunch of papers where people were like, damn, this is why you shouldn't do revolution. And I was like, fuck, that's not what I wanted you to take from this. Like, I wanted you to take that the stakes are really high, but that, like, this will always be the case. If we struggle against injustice, the stakes will be high, and we will have to make choices that don't have necessarily clear and obvious, like, you're never going to get a clear and obvious win. You're always going to get partial victories. And even when you win, it's going to be, it's going to be run through with loss and defeat and pain.
Yes.
And I think this movie's trying to do the same thing. It's trying to say the same thing. But I think it's just actually really hard to do that without simultaneously running into the problem that you identified, which is, you know, like suggesting that it's pointless, that maybe it would have been better to do none of this. Because at some level...
And I don't criticize it...
Sorry, no.
Sorry, I don't criticize it too harshly. Just this is a very, very quick interjection. The reason I don't criticize it too harshly for that is that I do think, like... there is a certain point where you are not responsible for the stupidity of your audience. Like, you're, and I'm not saying that anyone who thinks this would be stupid necessarily, but like, there is a certain, like, I do not believe in spoon feeding the audience by any means, but just, I will say that for this movie specifically, I feel like it could have been very easy to just remind people that, like, that, you know, this conflict did result ultimately in a real victory for workers.
And
they did not take that path, and that deserves, like, at least to be noted.
You could have, like, just like, you know, on the screen, you could just have it sort of say, like, this is the number you know, this is the number of workers that died in these, in the wars that came, you know, these are the number of casualties taken, and here's what was won eventually. Like, you could do that and still leave it somewhat ambiguous. But I mean, I think you raised the right point, and I think it's like, it's a thing that is worth kind of ending on, because films like this, I think, do a really good job of telling us something very profound, actually, which is that real struggle, if we are real about it, and if we are trying to take it seriously, and we're not liberals and we're not all talk, but we're willing to, like, take a stand on behalf of the people around us, and ourselves, and fight for a better world, we're going to sustain losses, real heavy, serious losses that are going to make us think maybe this was not worth it. We are going to, in every case that we stand up and fight, we are going to have moments where we think it might've been better to do nothing at all. And I think that's what these films are sort of teasing out. And I think both of them don't want us to end there. They both, you know, Ken Loach's films and this film, they want us to end on, yes, we should struggle. But boy, it's a tricky thing to get right. And I think you're right.
And that is why I think to go back full circle here, that is why I don't think we have covered a better movie or rather, I shouldn't say a better movie, because obviously, like, there are movies, you know, like, It's a Wonderful Life is my favorite movie, so, yeah. You know, but, like, ideologically, or, like, in terms of depicting history, depicting historical materialism, depicting dialectical materialism, and depicting, like, a historical event or figure properly, and from a, like, a viewpoint that I consider to be ideologically sound and consistent, I don't think we've covered a better movie since our first episode.
Yeah, agreed.
Doing Shay. Yeah. Because Shay, and it could be just the simple, you know, hilariously, like, capitalist, like, decision to split the movie in two parts, but it is dialectical, yeah, in that you see precisely, as you said, like part two being the answer to put the question posed in part, yeah, one, which is, why are we not doing, exactly, this everywhere all the time? Yeah. But the difference is that when you watch that movie, you cannot get the impression that this guy died for no,
totally,
reason, because you see it. You see a victory and a defeat.
Yeah.
And you know, I mean, obviously, depending on what your outlook on the Cuban Revolution is or whatever, you could come away thinking a variety of different things, but, like, you see both. Yeah. So you are the dialectic is present in the movie. It's depicted in the movie, and you can see, like, yes, there are victories and losses.
Yes.
Like, there are positives and negatives. And with this movie, it's possibly just that it's beyond the scope of the movie.
Yeah.
But the part of the reason I bring it up is because I know that's not what they were trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that's not what they were trying to do. There's nothing in the movie that would, to me, would give you the impression at all that you aren't supposed to be on the side of the workers completely,
oh, yeah,
unequivocally. The bad guys in this movie are movie bad guys. They're movie villains. They're cartoonishly evil. But I do think, unfortunately, that it could give people the mistaken impression that that this is pointless.
Yeah, better to do nothing.
Or this was pointless. Better to do nothing. Because,
yeah,
that's totally not the case.
Yeah. No, I agree. I'm with you there.
And on, like, to kind of put a pin in that, it's funny that you say that you assign this movie to students, because my takeaway, I say I would give this movie like a 4.5 out of 5. And my takeaway is that it is in the very near the top tier of it's a Monday or a Tuesday. You're in school. You're tired. Your teacher is very clearly hungover in retrospect, yeah, as an adult. And they have wheeled in the TV.
Totally.
And it's time to watch a movie.
Yeah.
And, like, you know, I would say, like, I don't know what the very top tier of that movie is. It's probably, like, Norma Rae,
yeah,
or something,
yeah,
which is another union movie that we should cover.
Yeah.
You know, it's that kind of thing. That's near the top tier for me. And this is kind of right in that conversation,
oh, yeah,
but, like, not quite as good as normal.
I can totally,
but
I can
very,
see it. I can, I'm there. I'm in,
yeah,
the classroom. I'm seeing the TV being wheeled in.
Very, very high end, like, teacher showing a movie.
Oh, yeah.
Anything else to end it,
no,
on, or
this is,
I still want to get to the other thing we were going to do.
Yeah,
there,
no,
so.
this is good. I also give it a 4.5, and I'm
great,
glad you,
yeah,
liked it as much as you did, because this was my pick, and I wanted to give you a good one. So.
Yeah, I want to watch it again. I would love to see somebody re-explore this subject matter, whether it's another movie about the same thing, or even a remake. I would love a remake of this movie if it was done well, or like a Sid Hatfield movie, because this movie kind of ends before the ending,
yeah,
in my opinion,
yeah,
in a lot of ways. Like I said, justifiable artistically,
yeah,
but I would love to see this subject matter covered in the future. Thanks for listening, everybody, and we'll have a bonus episode up on your feeds very soon after this. So enjoy, have a good one.